The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
Proteins are an essential part of a healthy body. But when they malfunction, the results can be disastrous. That's why a research team at UW-Milwaukee is so excited about the work that they're doing to help capture images of proteins that could lead to the development of new drug treatments. The UWM team is part of a $25 million National Science Foundation Science and Technology Center called Biology and X-ray Lasers. They have partners on the East and West Coast, but some of the most significant work being done right here in Milwaukee. Our guests joining us in the studio today are Abbas Ormaz, who's UWM's Distinguished Professor of Physics and Electrical Engineering, Delano Saldin, also a Distinguished Professor in Physics, and Mario Schmidt, who's an Associate Professor of Physics, all part of the UWM team. Let's begin with you, Abbas. First of all, congratulations. This is a pretty big deal, a $25 million grant that UWM will have a significant stake in.
Oh, thank you very much. We feel very fortunate.
It is something that you, I know, have worked on for some time. I recall years ago you talking about the potential of working in this area.
That's right. Actually, the idea first came to me in a shower, of course, a canonical shower. And I remember, now that you mention it, that we actually talked about it briefly. Those days I was an administrator, but science was beckoning already.
Yeah. Well, let's describe for the listeners exactly how this process works, the idea of being able to capture these images of these incredibly, incredibly small proteins.
Well, so the issue is this. You'd like to capture an image of a protein. Now, protein is a constituent of our body, and you know that our bodies are radiation sensitive. That's why, for example, if you go to the dentist, they make sure that only your teeth are irradiated, or pregnant women are advised not to have x-rays. So the difficulty about capturing an image of a protein, particularly with x-rays, is that, of course, you damage it as you look at it. That's a real problem. Now, it actually turns out that it's possible to use a very short pulse of x-rays, and I'll say how short in just a moment, and a very powerful one, which would actually just destroys the protein. However, if the pulse is very short, you can actually capture an image of the protein before it's blown apart. So that's the fundamental idea. But of course, there are many technical problems with this. One, that the number of photons, x-rays scattered by the protein is so frightfully small, it's very difficult to dig it out. And we use sophisticated mathematical techniques to do that. But the fundamental breakthrough, if you like, is the idea that you can actually take an image of something before you've blown it up.
And that's incredibly important, because otherwise you end up essentially destroying the evidence, the particle itself that you're trying to study.
And that's exactly the problem which all other techniques have struggled with and struggled against for many years.
So let's talk about the team. You are working in the laboratories, but alongside you have Delano and you have Marius. What roles do each of you play in this process of studying these very, very tiny proteins?
Well, first of all, Delano and I go back a long way. We were actually both together at Oxford, and I remember he was a very mischievous young man, and nothing has changed since then.
You'll get your shot in just a moment, Delano.
Thank you for that level of honesty, Delano. Much appreciated. But Delano and I are both really theorists, if you like, mathematicians, in a sense. And we work on algorithms, how to make a three-dimensional image of the object from these very faint snapshots. But perhaps Delano and I use different techniques, but perhaps Delano can tell us about some of his ideas.
Okay, so the first thing I want to say is that this new machine, the X-ray free electron laser, produces X-rays which are 10 billion times brighter than any existing X-ray source. That's 10 billion but in going from a typical crystal that is studied with conventional X-rays to a single molecule, you reduce the size of the sample by a factor of 100 times as much. So the diffraction patterns that you measure from a single molecule are roughly 100 times weaker than those from a conventional source. So much of the theoretical work is about extracting information from these very weak diffraction patterns.
Because now, there's so much information there, right?
There's a lot of information, especially because these pulses of X-rays come in very rapidly, and you can measure a very large number of scattering patterns per second. But you have to somehow combine all that information in such a way as to get rid of the extraneous noise and to get at the signal. As Abbas said, we have different ways of attacking this problem. So if you want to know about the method that I'm using, I'm using a method which assumes that you can extract information from a large number of molecules hit simultaneously by this powerful X-ray source, even though these molecules are not necessarily aligned to one another as they would be in a crystal, which is the conventional method of studying these things with X-rays. So in a sense, I try to overcome this problem of the very weak diffraction patterns by hitting not one molecule but a large number of them at the same time.
And so you've got one approach, and how does that differ from Abbas, the work that you're doing?
Well, so the problem is this, right? Imagine you're standing in a noisy airport and you're trying to listen to one person singing a song. You have normally no hope of hearing that. And so what people have done really for the past 60 years is that instead of trying to listen to a single singing voice, they get a choir together and they all sing the same song together at the same time, and so you can hear them. The problem is many proteins don't like to form choirs. A choir of crystals is a choir of molecules is a crystal, like a sugar crystal. And so they've coaxed proteins to form these crystals, and then because they all sing the same song, you can hear them. You can essentially capture the snapshots. What we are trying to do, both Delano and I and Marius, is to say, actually, we really want to hear the voice of a single protein. Why? Because when you hear a choir, you don't hear a single voice. You hear the average voice. And we want to actually hear a single protein, or in fact, see a single protein. So what you have to contend with is the very low signal and a very high background, as in a busy, noisy airport. Now, there are many ways of doing it. What Delano is working on is saying, actually, I'm going to have a gaggle of proteins, a choir, not all singing the same song at the same time, and I'm going to essentially extract the song of one from the song sung by many. That's a very clever approach. The other alternative is to say, actually, I'm going to catch the whisper singing of a single individual in this noisy airport. If I have a way of detecting a very small signal in a lot of noise. And it turns out both techniques work theoretically, and now we're trying to test to see which one works better experimentally.
Marius, talk about your role. We've got the mathematicians here looking for that voice in the airport crowd. Where does your work come in?
I have a little bit a different approach to this. Since I have a long-standing career in biophysics and as an experimentalist, and I started basically my career in this field in 1998 when I was a postdoc in Keith Moffat's lab. He is the pioneer of time-resolved crystallography, and he lives and works in Chicago, right? And since then, I perfected a certain method that can be used for to analyze time-resolved crystallographic data, and that is something that I can use also to analyze data from this superb machine. And you can imagine, of course, in the moment, I'm primarily concerned still with the choir, with crystals, but we don't want to have a static image of that crystal. We want to see how the molecules in that crystal move as a function of time. So what we do, we start a reaction, and we follow this reaction in that crystal from the very beginning with the very fastest events to the very end with the slowest event. And then we can characterize this entire reaction, a chemical reaction, if you will, or maybe one can also say a protein-catalyzed reaction with this machine.
This is really basic research, isn't it, when you you think about what the end game of this might be?
Well, it's basic research. That's the beauty of it, with immediate applications. So imagine you actually want to put a drug. You want to get a drug to interact with a protein. You want to see how that interaction takes place as a function of time and what effect it has on the protein. And so you can see from this beautiful fundamental work Marius described, where you look at how a protein evolves in shape. Now you can immediately go to say, how does this evolution with time, how is it modified if I add a drug to the protein? And so what I really like about this project is that on the one hand, you're really using beautiful mathematics, beautiful experimental, very fundamental experimental questions, which are only a short way to having immediate applications.
Well, and this is different. This is a breakthrough because in the past, the way in which you would study the reaction of drugs, for example, on proteins would be a process that took much, much longer, didn't it?
Well, much longer and also fraught with difficulty in the following sense. So what is the standard way of finding out what a drug does? Well, first of all, you put a little bit on a few cells in a petri dish. If the petri dish cells survive, you give it to a zebrafish or maybe a rat. Then you go to a mouse and a rabbit and eventually chimpanzees, and then you try it on people. And then when you try it on a large number of people, sometimes you find actually it doesn't work very well. So let me give you an example. Drug on the market was against nausea, would give people a splitting headache. And people went into great detail, and it turned out that the molecule was helical, it was like a helix, and whether it was right-handed or left-handed determined whether you got a headache or not. And so just understanding the structure of these proteins tells you a lot already about how they function, and it tells you a lot also about how you can interfere with their function to achieve specific ends. How would you, for example, introduce a drug? One of the primary difficulties nowadays is HIV. We've all heard about that. It's a particular virus, a very nasty one. And the problem is that it changes most of its surface proteins. So as soon as you develop a drug against it, it evolves itself to look differently on the surface, so it's not recognized anymore. And so the question being asked right now is, well, which part of this virus, this HIV virus, does not change? Because there must be a part which doesn't change. And if you can identify that and you can target that part, then you have an effective cure. And so you have this beautiful mix of mathematics, physics, biology, really going all the way with implications for therapeutic intervention. And this comes back to the idea of a science and technology center, because these centers are specifically, a very small number of these centers is set up every 3 or 4 years, specifically to tackle essentially transformative problems. That's to say, these are problems, if you had a solution, you could really make radical changes to not only to our fundamental knowledge, but also how to science can be useful.
What are the reasons, I presume, that the NSF, National Science Foundation, decided to fund this project at this time? Is not only do they have a wonderful collection of very smart people, like the three of you sitting at the table.
We love to hear you say that.
And I'm happy to say it because you are in another league. I absolutely marvel at the work that comes out of our physics department. But also the technology has evolved. And this is where I'd like to bring in some of the story of the other partners you have, because a big part of what you're doing here is reliant upon a piece of equipment that's being used out at Stanford, isn't it?
That's right.
Describe the tool that they have there that is really at the center of the work that is being undertaken here in Milwaukee.
It's called the LCLS. Yeah. It's called L for Linac, C for coherent, L for light, and S for source. LCLS, Linac coherent light source. And it's a so-called free electron laser. And the free electron laser works because you have electrons of enormous energy which you funnel into a pattern of magnets, into a grid of magnets, and then the electrons produce electromagnetic radiation, X-rays, in this grid of magnets. And the electromagnetic radiation becomes so strong that it interacts with the electrons themselves, and that gives rise to an exponential increase of intensity of the X-rays. And that, therefore, it's kind of similar to a laser, because you get this amplification. And this is a free, it's then called a free electron laser that, as Delano has pointed out, is 10 billion times more bright than any existing X-ray source so far.
Delano, how long has this been around, the new equipment, laser?
Well, the machine that Marius mentioned, the Linac coherent light source, is actually the world's first operating X-ray laser. And I believe it has been operating only for about 3 years or so now. There are other X-ray lasers. The second one is now operating, the one in Japan, which is called SAKLA, which operates close to Osaka. And the third one is due to come online in a couple of years in Germany, in Hamburg. So there are not that many of these machines in operation up to now. And we are fortunate to be working with amongst the very first of them.
Well, and that's really important to the story that we're telling today because, well, we have the expertise that each of the three of you bring to the table in mathematics and biology and so on. You did not have the equipment necessary to really advance the research that you're currently engaged in.
That's right. Actually, it's an important point. So this machine, the LCLS's X-ray laser, is actually 3 kilometers long. And it has a distinguished history because in a previous incarnation, it actually was used to look at elementary particles and led to a Nobel Prize for the discovery of a new type of elementary particle. And it's now being used in a different way to produce these very bright flashes of X-rays. And in fact, science is moving in the following way. The experimental tools are now so expensive and so specialized that really nobody can afford to have one to themselves. And so there's so-called user facilities. And the United States established the first X-ray laser. Actually, it's a part of the Department of Energy, which is in a national lab right next to Stanford. And the machine came online, as Delano said, just about 4 years ago, when the first photons came out. And the great thing about about this STC is this. Now, I used to work in Germany, as you know, and was involved in research there for many years. And the Germans, right off the bat, went off and set up a whole research facility to specialize and work on X-rays. The American approach is a bit different. It's much more entrepreneurial. And so although the Department of Energy built this large machine, they didn't actually set up a research group to use it. They said, you go for it. And so there was a period of intense competition, essentially, from between many groups to establish the techniques. And that has now led, as a consequence of the competition, to the establishment of this Science and Technology Center to specialize in using this machine to look at biology, biological problems.
We're going to talk about your partners in just a moment, but first let me remind our listeners that you're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us. In the studio today, Abbas Ormaz, Delano Saldin and Mario Schmidt, all faculty and professors in the Department of Physics at UWM, working on an absolutely amazing project. The National Science Foundation has given a $25 million grant to study the biology and through the use of an X-ray laser, more specifically looking at proteins, a very, very tiny part of the building pyramid of the human body that that sometimes goes wrong and needs the treatment of drugs that hopefully will come out of this work. You talk about the partnerships that the three of you have formed with each of your specific strengths and skills here in Milwaukee, but there are other universities that are also involved in this particular project. Who are they, and how did you all come together to dance this dance of trying to get answers to questions that we've been wondering about for a long time? Delano, let's start with you.
I'll list some of the other institutions that are being involved in this project. One is Cornell University, Arizona State University. Let me see, what are the others?
Well, maybe I can jump in with a couple.
Yeah, please.
So this is a group of about a dozen institutions. There are three main partners in that. There is the Arizona State University. There's the Hartman Woodward Institute in Buffalo, which is a part of SUNY Buffalo, and UW Milwaukee. So these are the three primary institutions. But the other institutions include Cornell, Stanford, University of California, San Francisco, Rice, and other institutions, but they tend to have smaller efforts. And so this has really been a question of unabashed cherry-picking. In putting the team together, and you ask, how did we come together? We really went and cherry-picked for the best across the nation. And so, for example, you have Roger Kornberg at Stanford, who was a Nobel Prize winner just recently for the structural proteins. You have Bob Stroud at UC San Francisco, one of the pioneers in determining the structural proteins. You have colleagues from Arizona State University, pioneers in determining the structural proteins and also the experimental means for doing that. And the list goes on. So really, it was a question of excellence seeking out excellence. And we were very fortunate, actually, because we were approached by others to join. And in fact, UWM was asked whether we would lead the effort. And it was a request which we actually in the end turned down. But it shows, for me, two things. First of all, it shows that it's excellence speaks for itself in the end. But more importantly, I think, that there is a great deal of excellence at UWM, not just us. I don't think we're the only group which can play at this level. And I think it's very important that this kind of success breeds other success by giving others the confidence and shows the level at which UWM campus is playing in research across the board, not only in this area.
Although this is, I believe, the largest NSF grant that UWM has ever shared in or been a major party in.
Well, it's true. So there were only three science and technology centers in this round. I like to compare the award for science and technology centers really to the Olympic Games, because the awards occur every 3 or 4 years. It's all comers, all fields, and there are only 3 to 5 awards. And in fact, this year there were only 3. And so it's like Olympic Games, where there are only 3 medals across all fields. So we feel very fortunate.
I want to ask Marius about the experience of working with all of these collaborators. How do you keep things straight? If you have individuals at institutions around the country, each taking a nibble off of this this problem, how is it all coordinated?
Maybe I give an example here. We recently applied for BeamTime at the LCLS, and BeamTime is extremely competitive, extremely competitive. The success rate of a proposal that proposes some experiment to get BeamTime for is maybe less than 10%. And in order to be successful for such a proposal, you have to assemble a team. And every member of that team has to have a certain duty or a certain reputation or something that he or she can provide to this experiment. And this is exactly what we did recently, right? So we applied for beam time in this upcoming LCLS run. There we are a team of 30 people, of which 28 belong to the STC. Two are outside professors. And that's a good thing because, of course, as a team, we can also invite outside professors. That adds to our reputation, also to our excellence, of course, because these people are excellent scientists, but they're not in this STC. So we are a group of 30 people. Now we have to manage to come together to do this experiment. And, of course, each and everybody has his duty. The Arizona team, for example, they have to come up with the injector technology. The UWM team has to come up with the production of proteins and crystals and algorithms, like here in case of Abbasi, develop some algorithms to help us with the data reduction. This is one proposal that we have put in. And then, of course, everything has to be organized. The beam time was then approved for June. So until June, we have to come up with a functional setup of that our experiment gives us the best sample possible and the best team possible.
So it's enormous competition for this beam time, the use of this wonderful equipment. How long do you have to work with the beam itself?
Well, typically an experiment consists of 5 12-hour shifts, mm-hmm. and the shifts can run overnight, and we've all participated in that. And so you start at 7 in the evening, you have a preliminary discussion, your beam time starts at 9 in the evening, and it goes till 9 o'clock the next day. And you do that for 5 days at a time.
So you better have everything organized and everybody's assignment right on,
exactly.
Correct, Delano? Or else,
yes.
Or else it's a waste.
You run absolutely. The risk. Yes, absolutely. In fact, one needs to prepare these experiments a long time in advance, exactly what you plan to do, what you plan to test, and so on.
Do you find that you're no longer competitors when you are drawn together in a collaboration like this?
It's really a self-organizing system. So you turn up. Even during the proposal formation stage, and everyone contributes what they can. And Marius did a wonderful job putting together a terrific proposal, and it was really an example of how to get a group to organize itself with the lightest of touches. I just saw that from the sidelines. I'm actually involved in that proposal supporting Marius, but that's the way to do it. That's really leadership in it.
A little nudge instead of a push.
Nudge at the critical point of the discussion.
Yeah.
But, you know, what's important is also that you don't want to keep your things by yourself. You distribute this to other people. Like I sent protein away to other groups in Arizona, to Berkeley. Actually, it's Livermore. And also to Hamburg, and they are always all working on my samples. This is not my samples anymore. That's then their samples to get the optimum sample for that experiment. And when they find something out, it will be published, but it will not be published as a single group, but will be published with the entire people that are involved in this experiment, right? So rather than having two people on the publication, you have an entire group, and that is also something very interesting, right? And so there is no competition. There's just collaboration.
Well, we are going to invite you back to report on the results of this fabulous collaboration. Sadly, we're out of time. It's such a fascinating, fascinating topic. But the good news is that you're going to be working on this for a while, and I think our listeners would love to hear the outcome of this incredible accomplishment that UWM and your collaborators are involved in first receiving the NSF Award and then putting the money to good use to, at the end, most importantly, get a breakthrough that helps other people. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much. You.
My pleasure. Abbas Ormaz, Delano Saldin, and Mario Schmidt, all part of the UWM world-famous physics department, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We will be back next week as we take another look at the amazing work that faculty, staff, and yes, even students do at a research university like UWM. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.